Chapter 15. On his way back to the cabin, the sun flaring in his eyes and kicking off a headache to go with his other symptoms, Drew brooded on that snotty bandana. Also, on how Roy DeWitt had tried to man through it and wound up in the hospital. He glanced into the rearview mirror and briefly regarded his red, watery eyes. I am not getting the fucking flu. Not when I'm on a roll. Okay, but why in God's name had he shaken that son of a bitch's hand when it had undoubtedly been crawling with germs? One so big you'd hardly need a microscope to see them. And since he had, why hadn't he asked for the bathroom so he could wash them? Christ, his kids knew about hand washing. He'd taught them himself. I'm not getting the fucking flu, he repeated, then dropped the visor to keep the sun out of his eyes. To keep it from flaring in his eyes. Flaring? Or glaring? Was glaring better, or was it too much? He mused on this as he drove back to the cabin. He brought his groceries in and saw the message light was flashing. It was Lucy, asking that he call back as soon as possible. He felt that tug of annoyance again, the sense that she was looking over his shoulder. But then he realized it might not be about him. After all, not everything was. One of the kids might have gotten sick or had an accident. He called, and for the first time in a long time, since the village on the hill, probably, they argued. Not as bad as some of the arguments they'd had in the first years of their marriage, when the kids had been small and money tight. Those had been doozies. But bad enough. She had also heard about the storm. Of course she had. She was a Weather Channel addict. And she wanted him to pack up and come home. Drew told her that was a bad idea. Terrible, in fact. He had established a good working rhythm and was getting awesome stuff. A one-day break in that rhythm, and it would probably end up being two or even three, might not put the book in jeopardy, but a change in his writing environment could. He would have thought she understood the delicacy of creative work, at least for him, after all these years, but it seemed she didn't. What you don't understand is how bad this storm is supposed to be. Haven't you been watching the news? No. And then, lying for no good reason, unless it was because he felt spiteful toward her just now. I have no reception. The dish doesn't work. Well, it's going to be bad, especially up north in those unincorporated townships near the border. That's where you are, in case you didn't notice. They're expecting widespread power outages because of the wind. Good thing I brought Pop's type. Drew, will you let me finish just this once? He fell silent, his head throbbing and his throat aching. In that moment, he didn't like his wife very much. Loved her, sure, always would, but didn't like her. Now she'll say thank you, he thought. Thank you, she said. I know you took your father's portable, but you'd be down to candlelight and cold food for days, maybe much longer. I can cook on the wood stove. It was on the tip of his tongue to say that, but if he broke in on her again, the argument would veer onto a new subject, the one about how he didn't take her seriously, so on, and yada, yada, yada. I suppose you could cook on the wood stove, she said, in a slightly more reasonable tone. But if the wind blows like they say it's going to, a gale force sustained, hurricane force gusts, a lot of trees are going to fall down and you'll be stuck out there. I planned to be out here anyway, he thought, but again held his tongue. I know you were planning to be out there for 2 or 3 weeks anyway, she said, but a tree could also knock a hole in the roof, and the phone line is going to come down with the power line, and you'll be cut off. What if something happened to you? Nothing's going to... Maybe not, but what if something happened to us? Then you take care of it, he said. I wouldn't have gone herring off to the middle of nowhere if I didn't think you could do that. And you have your sis. Besides, they exaggerate the weather reports. You know that. They turn 6 inches of fresh powder into the storm of the century. It's all about ratings. This will be the same. You'll see. Thank you for mansplaining that, Lucy said. Her tone was flat. So here they were, going to that sore place he'd hoped to avoid, especially with his throat, sinuses, and ear throbbing, not to mention his head. Unless he was very diplomatic, they would be mired in the time-honored, or was dishonored, more accurate, argument about who knew better. From there, they, no, she, could move on to the horrors of the paternalistic society. This was a subject upon which Lucy could expatiate endlessly. "You want to know what I think, Drew? I think when a man says, 'You know that,' which they do all the time, what they mean is, 'I know that, but you're too dumb to know that. Hence, I must mansplain.'" He sighed, and when the sigh threatened to turn into a cough, he stifled it. "Really? You want to go there?" "Drew, we are there." The weariness in her tone, as if he were a stupid child that could not seem to get even the simplest lesson, infuriated him. "Okay, here's a little more mansplaining, Luce. For most of my adult life, I've been trying to write a novel. Do I know why? No. I only know it's the missing piece in my life. I need to do this. And I am doing it. It's very, very important. You're asking me to risk that." "Is it as important as me and the kids?" "Oh, of course not. But does it have to be a choice?" "I think it is a choice. And you just made it." He laughed, and the laugh turned into a cough. "That's pretty melodramatic." She didn't chase that one. She had something else to chase. "Drew, are you okay? Not coming down with something, are you?" In his mind, he heard the scrawny woman with the stud in her lips saying, "Had to be a man about it, and went pneumonia." "No," he said. "Allergies." "Will you think about coming back, at least? Will you do that?" "Yes." Another lie. He already had thought about it. "Call tonight, okay? Talk to the kids." "Can I talk to you, too? If I promise not to mansplain anything?" She laughed. Well, actually more of a chuckle, but still a good sign. "Fine. I love you, Luce." "I love you, too," she said. And as he hung up, he had an idea, what English teachers like to call an epiphany, he supposed, that her feelings were probably not much different from his. Yes, she loved him, he was sure of it. But on this afternoon, in early October, she didn't like him much. He was sure of that, too. Chapter 16. According to the label, Dr. King's cough and cold remedy was 26% alcohol, but after a healthy knock from the bottle that made Drew's eyes water and brought on a serious coughing fit, he guessed the manufacturer might have lowballed the content. Maybe just enough to keep it off the big 90s liquor shelf with the coffee brandy, the apricot schnapps, and the fireball nips. But it cleared his sinuses most righteously, and when he spoke to Brandon that evening, his boy detected nothing out of the ordinary. It was Stacy who asked him if he was okay. Allergies, he told her, and repeated the same lie to Lucy when she took back her phone. At least there was no argument with her tonight, just the unmistakable trace of chill in her voice that he knew well. It was chilly outside as well. Indian summer seemed to be over. Drew had an attack of the shivers and built up a good fire in the wood stove. He sat close to it in Pop's rocker, had another knock of Dr. King's, and read an old John D. MacDonald. From the credit page at the front, it looked like MacDonald had written 60 or 70 books. No problem finding the right word or phrase there, it seemed, and by the end of his life, he had even attained some critical cred. Lucky him. Drew read a couple of chapters, then went to bed, hoping his cold would be better in the morning, and also hoping he wouldn't have a cough syrup hangover. His sleep was uneasy and dream-haunted. He couldn't remember much of those dreams the next morning, only that, in one of them, he had been in a seemingly endless hallway, lined with doors on both sides. One of them, he felt sure, led to a way out, but he couldn't decide which one to try, and before he could pick one, he woke up to a cold, clear morning, a full bladder, and aching joints. He made his way to the bathroom at the end of the gallery, cursing Roy DeWitt and his besnotted bandana. Chapter 17. His fever was still there, but it seemed to be lower, and the combination of Goody's headache powder and Dr. King's helped with his other symptoms. The work went pretty well, only 10 pages instead of 18, but still amazing for him. It was true that he had to pause every now and then, looking for the right word or phrase, but he chalked that up to the infection running around in his body. And those words and phrases always came after a few seconds, clicking neatly into place. The story was getting good. Sheriff Jim Averill had the killer in jail, but the gun thugs had showed up on an unscheduled train, a midnight special paid for by Andy Prescott's rich rancher daddy, and now they were laying siege to the town. Unlike Village, this book was more about plot than character and situation. That had worried Drew a little to begin with. As a teacher and reader, they weren't the same, but surely first cousins. He had a tendency to concentrate on theme, language, and symbolism rather than story. But the pieces also seemed to be clicking into place, almost of their own accord. Best of all, there was a strange bond beginning to form between Averill and the Prescott kid, which gave his story a resonance as unexpected as that midnight train. Instead of going for an afternoon walk, he turned on the TV and, after a lengthy hunt through the DirecTV on-screen guide, found the Weather Channel. Having access to such a bewildering array of video input up here in the Willywags might have amused him on another day, but not on this one. His long session at the laptop had left him wrung out, almost hollowed out, instead of energized. Why in God's name had he shaken DeWitt's hand? Common politeness, of course, and completely understandable, but why in God's name hadn't he washed afterwards? Been through all that, he thought. Yes, and here it was again, gnawing away. It sort of reminded him of his catastrophic last try at novel writing, when he would lie awake long after Lucy had gone to sleep, mentally deconstructing and reconstructing the few paragraphs he'd managed that day, picking at the work until it bled. Stop. That's the past. This is now. Watch the goddamn weather report. But it wasn't a report. The Weather Channel would never be so minimalist. This was a fucking opera of doom and gloom. Drew hadn't been able to understand his wife's love affair with the Weather Channel, which seemed populated solely by meteorological geeks. As if to underline this, they now gave names to even non-hurricane storms. The one the store clerk had warned him about, the one his wife was so worried about, had been dubbed Pierre. Drew could not conceive of a stupider name for a storm. It was swooping down from Saskatchewan on a northeast track, which made the woman with the lip stud full of shit. It was a nor'easter that would bring it to TR-90 either tomorrow afternoon or evening. It was packing 40-mile-an-hour sustained winds with gusts up to 65. You might think that doesn't sound too bad, said the current weather geek, a young man with a fashionable beard scruff that made Drew's eyes hurt. Mr. Scruffy was a poet of the Pierre apocalypse, not quite speaking in iambic pentameter, but close. What you need to remember, though, is that temperatures are going to fall radically when this front comes through. I mean, they're going to drop off the table. Rain could turn to sleet, and you drivers up there in northern New England can't discount the possibility of black ice. Maybe I should go home, Drew thought. But it was no longer just the book that was keeping him. The idea of that long drive out Shithouse Road feeling as drained as he did today made him even more tired. And when he finally made it to something approximating civilization, was he supposed to go tooling down I-95, sipping away at alcohol-laced cold medicine? The major thing, though, the scruffy weather geek was saying, is that this baby is going to meet a ridge of high pressure coming in from east, a very unusual phenomenon. That means our friends north of Boston could be in for what the old Yankees called a three-day blow. Blow on this, Drew thought and grabbed his crotch. Later, after an unsuccessful try at napping, all he did was toss and turn. Lucy called. Listen to me, mister. He hated when she called him that. It was like fingers dragged down a blackboard. The forecast is only getting worse. You need to come home. Lucy, it's a storm, what my pop used to call a cap of wind, not nuclear war. You need to come home while you still can. He had had enough of this, and enough of her. No, I need to be here. You're a fool, she said. Then, for the first time he could remember, she hung up on him. Chapter 18. Drew turned on the Weather Channel as soon as he got up the following morning, thinking, "As a dog returneth to its vomit, so a fool repeateth his folly." He was hoping to hear that autumn storm Pierre had changed course. It had not. Nor had his cold changed course. It didn't seem worse, but it didn't seem better either. He called Lucy and got her voicemail. Possibly she was running errands. Possibly she just didn't want to talk with him. That was okay with Drew either way. She was pissed at him, but she would get over it. No one trashed 15 years of marriage over a storm, did they? Especially not one named Pierre. Drew scrambled a couple of eggs and managed to eat half of them before his stomach warned him that stuffing down more might lead to a forcible ejection. He scraped his plate into the garbage, sat down in front of the laptop, and called up the current document, Bitter River Number 3. He scrolled to where he had left off, looked at the white space beneath the blinking cursor, and started to fill it. The work went all right for the first hour or so, and then the trouble began. It started with the rocking chairs Sheriff Averill and his three deputies were meant to sit in outside the Bitter River Jail. They had to be sitting out front, in full view of the townsfolk and Dick Prescott's gun thugs, because that was the basis of the clever plan Averill had hatched to get Prescott's son out of town under the very noses of the hard men who were supposed to keep it from happening. The lawmen had to be seen, especially the deputy named Cal Hunt, who happened to be about the same height and build as the Prescott boy. Hunt was wearing a colorful Mexican serape and a 10-gallon hat decorated with silver conchos. The hat's extravagant brim obscured his face. That was important. The serape and hat weren't Deputy Hunt's. He said he felt like a fool in a hat like that. Sheriff Averill didn't care. He wanted Prescott's men to be looking at the clothes and not the man inside them. All fine. Good storytelling. Then the trouble came.
All right, Sheriff Averill told his deputies. It's time we took a little night air. Be seen by whoever wants to look at us. Hank, bring that jug. I want to be sure those boys on the rooftops get a good look at the dumb sheriff getting drunk with his even dumber deputies.
Do I have to wear this hat? Cal Hunt almost moaned. I'll never live it down.
What you ought to be concerned about is living through the night, Averill said. Now come on, let's just get these rocking chairs outside and...
That was where Drew stopped, transfixed by the image of the tiny Bitter River Sheriff's office containing 3 rocking chairs. No, 4 rocking chairs, because you had to add one for Averill himself. That was a lot more absurd than the 10-gallon face-obscuring Stetson Cal Hunt was wearing. And not only because 4 rockers would fill the whole damn room. The whole idea of rocking chairs was antithetical to law enforcement, even in a small western town like Bitter River. People would laugh. Drew deleted most of the sentence and looked at what was left.
Let's just get these...
These what, chairs? Would the sheriff's office even have 4 chairs? It seemed unlikely. Not like there's a fucking waiting room, Drew said, and wiped his forehead. Not in a... A sneeze surprised him, and he let go before he could cover his mouth, spattering the laptop's screen with a fine spray of spittle, distorting the words.
Fuck! Goddamn fuck!
He grabbed for tissues to wipe the screen, but the Kleenex box was empty. He got a dish towel instead, and when he'd finished cleaning the screen, he thought of how much the soggy dish towel looked like Roy DeWitt's bandana, his besnotted bandana.
Let's just get these...
Was his fever worse? Drew didn't want to believe that. Wanted to believe the growing heat he felt, plus the increased throbbing in his head, was just the pressure of trying to solve this idiotic rocking chair problem, so he could move on. But it certainly seemed like... This time he managed to turn aside before the sneezing started,
Not just one this time, but half a dozen. He seemed to feel his sinuses bulging with each one, like overinflated tires. His throat was throbbing, and so was his ear.
Let's just get these...
It came to him then. A bench. There might be a bench in the sheriff's office, where people could sit while they waited to do their little bits of business. He grinned and gave himself a thumbs up. Sick or not, the pieces were still falling into place, and was that really surprising? Creativity often seemed to run on its own clean circuit, regardless of the body's ills. Flannery O'Connor had lupus. Stanley Elkin had multiple sclerosis. Fyodor Dostoevsky had epilepsy, and Octavia Butler suffered from dyslexia. What was a lousy cold, maybe even the flu, compared to things like that? He could work through this. The bench proved it. The bench was genius.
Let's just get this bench outside and have a few drinks.
But we're not really going to drink, are we, Sheriff? Jep Leonard asked.
The plan had been explained to him carefully, but Jep was not exactly the brightest bulb in the... Brightest bulb in the chandelier? God, no. That was an anachronism. Or was it? The bulb part, for sure. No light bulbs in the 1880s. But there were chandeliers back then. Of course there were. There was one in the saloon. If he'd had an internet connection, he could have looked at any number of old-time examples of them, but he didn't. Just 200 channels of TV. Most of it total junk. Better to use a different metaphor. If it even was a metaphor, Drew wasn't completely sure. Maybe it was just a comparative something. No, it was a metaphor, he was sure of it. Almost. Never mind. That wasn't the point, and this wasn't a classroom exercise. It was a book. It was his book. So stick to the writing. Eyes on the prize. Not the ripest melon in the patch? Not the fastest horse in the race? No, those were awful. But then he got it. Magic! He bent and typed rapidly. The plan had been explained to him carefully, but Jep was not exactly the smartest kid in the classroom. Satisfied, well, relatively satisfied, Drew got up, had a knock of Dr. King's, then chased it with a glass of water to wash the taste out of his mouth, a slimy mixture of snot and cold medicine. This is like before. This is like what happened with Village. He could tell himself that wasn't true, that this time was entirely different, that the clean circuit wasn't so clean after all because he was running a fever, a pretty high one from the way it felt, and it was all because he'd handled that bandana. No, you didn't. You handled his hand. You handled the hand that handled the bandana. Handled the hand that handled the bandana. Right. He turned on the cold tap and splashed his face. That made him feel a little better. He mixed Goody's headache powder with more water, drank it off, then went to the door and threw it open. He felt quite sure that Moose Mom would be there, so sure that for a moment, thank you, Fever, he actually thought he did see her over there by the equipment shed, but it was only shadows moving in a slight breeze. He took a number of deep breaths. In goes the good air, out goes the bad. When I shook his hand, I must have been mad. Drew went back inside and sat down at the laptop. Pushing on seemed like a bad idea, but not pushing on seemed even worse. So he began to write, trying to recapture the wind that had filled his sails and brought him this far. At first, it seemed to be working, but by lunchtime, not that he had any interest in eating, his interior sails had gone slack. Probably it was being sick, but it was still too much like before. I seem to be losing my words. That was what he'd told Lucy, what he'd told Al Stamper. But that wasn't the truth. It was just what he could give them so they could dismiss it as writer's block, something he would eventually find his way through. Or it might dissolve on its own. In truth, it was the opposite. It was having too many words. Was it a copse or a grove? Was it flaring or glaring? Or maybe staring? Was a character sunken-eyed or hollow-eyed? Oh, and if hollow-eyed was hyphenated, what about sunken-eyed? He shut down at 1 o'clock. He had written 2 pages, and the feeling that he was reverting to the nervous and neurotic man who'd almost burned down his house 3 years ago was getting harder to dismiss. He could tell himself to let go of the small stuff like rocking chairs versus bench, to let the story carry him. But when he looked at the screen, every word there seemed wrong. Every word seemed to have a better one hiding behind it, just out of sight. Was it possible that he was coming down with Alzheimer's? Could that be it?
"Don't be dumb,"
he said, and was dismayed at how nasal he sounded. Also hoarse. Pretty soon he'd lose his voice entirely, not that there was anyone out here to talk to except himself. "Get your ass home. You got a wife and 2 fine kids to talk to." But if he did that, he would lose the book. He knew that as well as he knew his own name. After 4 or 5 days, when he was back in Falmouth and feeling better, he would open the Bitter River documents, and the prose there would look like something someone else had written, an alien story he would have no idea how to finish. Leaving now would be like throwing away a precious gift, one that might never be given again.
"Had to be a man about it, and it went pneumonia," Roy DeWitt's daughter had said, the subtext being, "Just another damn fool." And was he going to do the same?
The lady or the tiger? The book or your life? Was the choice really that stark and melodramatic? Surely not, but he surely felt like 10 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag. There was no doubt about that. Nap. I need a nap. When I wake up, I'll be able to decide. So he took another knock of Dr. King's magic elixir, or whatever it was called, and climbed the stairs to the bedroom he and Lucy had shared on other trips out here. He went to sleep, and when he woke up, the rain and wind had arrived, and the choice was made for him. He had a call to make, while he still could. Chapter 19.
"Hey, honey. It's me. I'm sorry I pissed you off."
"Really?"
She ignored this completely.
"It doesn't sound like allergies to me, mister. It sounds like you're sick."
"It's just a cold."
He cleared his throat, or tried to.
"A pretty bad one, I guess."
The throat clearing provoked coughing. He covered the mouthpiece of the old-fashioned phone, but he supposed she heard it anyway. The wind gusted, rain slapped against the windows, and the lights flickered.
"So now what? You just hole up?"
"I think I have to," he said,
then rushed on.
"It's not the book, not now. I'd come back if I thought it was safe, but that storm is here already. The lights just flickered. I'm going to lose power and the phone before dark, practically guaranteed. Here, I'll pause so you can say I told you so."
"I told you so," she said.
"And now that we've got that out of the way, how bad are you?"
"Not that bad," he said,
which was a far bigger lie than telling her the satellite dish didn't work. He thought he was quite bad indeed, but if he said that, it was hard to gauge how she might react. Would she call the Presque Isle cops and request a rescue? Even in his current condition, that seemed like an overreaction, not to mention embarrassing.
"I hate this, Drew. I hate you being up there and cut off. Are you sure you can't drive out?"
"I might have been able to earlier, but I took some cold medicine before I laid down for a nap and overslept. Now I don't dare chance it. There are still washouts and plugged culverts from last winter. A hard rain like this is apt to put long stretches of the road underwater. The Suburban might make it, but if it didn't, I could be stranded 6 miles from the cabin and 9 miles from the Big 90.
There was a pause, and in it, Drew fancied he could hear what she was thinking.
"Had to be a man about it, didn't you? Just another damn fool."
Because sometimes "I told you so" was just not enough. The wind gusted and the lights flickered again, or maybe they stuttered. The phone gave a cicada buzz, then cleared. "Drew, are you still there?"
"I'm here."
The phone made a funny sound.
"I heard it."
"You have food?"
"Plenty."
Not that he felt like eating. She sighed. "Then hunker down. Call me tonight if the phone still works."
"I will.
And when the weather breaks, I'll come home." "Not if there are trees down, you won't. Not until somebody decides to come in and clear the road."
"I'll clear them myself," Drew said. "Pop's chainsaw's in the equipment shed.
Unless one of the renters decided to take it. Any gas that was in the tank will have evaporated, but I can siphon some out of the Suburban." "If you don't get sicker."
"I won't."
"I'm going to tell the kids you're fine." Talking to herself more than him now. No sense worrying them, too.
This is fucked up, Drew."
She hated it when he interrupted her, but had never had any qualms about doing it herself. "I want you to know that. When you put yourself in this position, you put us in it, too." "I'm sorry." "Is the book still going well?" "It better be. It better be worth all the worry."
"It's going fine."
He was no longer sure of this, but what else could he tell her?
"The shit's starting again, Lucy. And now I'm sick as well?"
Would that ease her mind? "All right," she sighed. "You're an idiot, but I love you."
"Love you too."
The wind whooped, and suddenly the only light in the cabin was the dim and watery stuff coming in through the windows.
"Lucy, I just lost the lights."
He sounded calm, and that was good. "Look in the equipment shed," she said. "There might be a Coleman lantern." There was another of those cicada buzzes, and then nothing but silence. He replaced the old-fashioned phone in its cradle. He was on his own. Chapter 20. He grabbed a musty old jacket from one of the hooks by the door and fought his way to the equipment shed through the late light, raising his arm once to fend off a flying branch. Maybe it was being sick, but the wind felt like it was already blowing 40 per. He fumbled through the keys, cold water trickling down the back of his neck in spite of the jacket's turned-up collar, and had to try three before he found the one that fit the padlock on the door. Once again, he had to diddle it back and forth to get it to turn, and by the time it did, he was soaked and coughing. The shed was dark and full of shadows, even with the door wide open, but there was enough light to see Pop's chainsaw sitting on a table at the back. There were also a couple of other saws, one a two-handed buck, and probably that was good, because the chainsaw looked useless. The yellow paint of the body was almost obscured by ancient grease. The cutting chain was badly rusted, and he couldn't imagine mustering the energy to yank the starter cord anyway. Lucy was right about the Coleman lantern, though. There were actually two of them, sitting on a shelf to the left of the door, along with a gallon can of fuel. But one of them was clearly useless, the globe shattered and the handle gone. The other one looked okay. The silk mantles were attached to the gas jets, which was good. With his hands shaking the way they were, he doubted if he would have been able to tie them down. "Should have thought of this sooner," he scolded himself. "Of course I should have gone home sooner, when I still could." When Drew tipped the can of fuel to the dimming afternoon light, he saw Pop's back-slanted printing on a strip of adhesive. "Use this, not unleaded gas." He shook the can. It was half full, not great, but maybe enough to last a 3-day blow if he rationed his use. He took the can and unbroken lantern back to the house, started to put them on the dining room table, then thought better of it. His hands were shaking, and he was bound to spill at least some of the fuel. He put the lantern in the sink instead, then shucked the sodden jacket. Before he could think about fueling the lantern, the coughing started again. He collapsed into one of the dining room chairs, hacking away until he felt he might pass out. The wind was howling, and something thudded on the roof, a much bigger branch than the one he'd fended off from the sound. When the coughing passed, he unscrewed the tap on the lantern's reservoir and went looking for a funnel. He didn't find one, so he tore off a strip of aluminum foil and fashioned a half-assed funnel from that. The fumes wanted to start the coughing again, but he controlled it until he got the lantern's little tank filled. When it was, he let go and bent over the counter with his burning forehead on one arm, hacking and choking and gasping for breath. The fit eventually passed, but the fever was worse than ever. Getting soaked probably didn't help, he thought. Once he got the Coleman lit, if he got it lit, he'd take some more aspirin, add a shot of headache powder and a knock of Dr. King's for good measure. He pumped the little gadget on the side to build pressure, opened the tap, then struck a kitchen match and slipped it through the ignition hole. For a moment there was nothing, but then the mantles lit up, the lights so bright and concentrated it made him wince. He took the Coleman to the cabin's single closet, looking for a flashlight. He found clothes, orange vests for hunting season, and an old pair of ice skates. He vaguely remembered skating on the brook with his brother on the few occasions they'd been up here in the winter. He found hats and gloves, and an elderly Electrolux vacuum cleaner that looked about as useful as the rusty chainsaw in the equipment shed. There was no flashlight. The wind rose to a shriek around the eaves, making his head hurt. Rain lashed the windows. The last of the daylight continued to drain away, and he thought this was going to be a very long night. His expedition to the shed and his struggle to get the lamp lit had occupied him, but now that those chores were done, he had time to be afraid. He was stuck here because of a book that was, he could admit it now, starting to unravel like the others. He was stuck, he was sick, and he was apt to get sicker.
I could die out here, he said in his new hoarse voice. I really could.
Best not to think of that. Best to load up the wood stove and get it cranking, because the night was going to be cold as well as long. Temperatures are going to fall radically when this front comes through. Wasn't that what the scruffy weather geek had said? And the counterwoman with the lip stud had said the same thing. Right down to the same metaphor, if it was a metaphor, which likened temperature to a physical object that could roll off a table. That brought him back to Deputy Jep, who was not the smartest kid in the classroom. Really? Had he actually thought that would do? It was a shitty metaphor, if it even was a metaphor. Not just weak, dead on arrival. As he loaded the stove, his feverish mind seemed to open a secret door, and he thought, a sandwich short of a picnic. Better. All foam and no beer. Better still because of the story's Western milieu.
Dumber than a bag of hammers. About as smart as a rock. Sharp as a mor- Stop it!
He almost begged. That was the problem. That secret door was the problem because
I have no control over it,
he said in his croaky voice and thought,
dumb as a frog with brain damage.
Drew struck the side of his head with the heel of his hand. His headache flared. He did it again, then again. When he'd had enough of that, he stuffed crumpled sheets of magazine under some kindling, scratched a match on the stovetop, and watched the flames lick up. Still holding the lit match, he looked at the pages of Bitter River stacked beside the printer and thought about what would happen if he touched them alight. He hadn't quite managed to burn down the house when he'd lit up the village on the hill. The fire trucks had arrived before the flames could do much more than scorch the walls of his study. But there would be no fire trucks out here on Shithouse Road. And the storm wouldn't stop the fire once it took hold, because the cabin was old and dry. Old as dirt. Dry as your grandmother's... The flame guttering along the matchstick reached his fingers. Drew shook it out, tossed it into the blazing stove, and slammed the grate shut.
It's not a bad book.
And I'm not going to die out here, he said. Not going to happen.
He turned off the Coleman to conserve the fuel, then sat down in the wing chair he spent his evenings in, reading paperbacks by John D. MacDonald and Elmore Leonard. There wasn't enough light to read by now, not with the Coleman off. Night had almost come, and the only light in the cabin was the shifting red eye of the fire seen through the wood stove's isinglass window. Drew pulled his chair a bit closer to the stove and wrapped his arms around himself to quell the shivers. He should change out of his damp shirt and pants and do it right away if he didn't want to get even sicker. He was still thinking this when he fell asleep.
Chapter 21. What woke him was a splintering crack from outside. It was followed by a second, even louder crack, and a thud that shook the floor. A tree had fallen, and it must have been a big one. The fire in the wood stove had burned down to a bed of bright red embers that waxed and waned. Along with the wind, he could now hear a sandy rattling against the windows. The cabin's big downstairs room was stuporously hot, at least for the time being, but the temperature outside must have fallen off the table, as predicted, because the rain had turned to sleet. Drew tried to check the time, but his wrist was bare. He supposed he'd left his watch on the night table beside the bed, although he couldn't remember for sure. He could always check the time and date strip on his laptop, he supposed, but what would be the point? It was nighttime in the North Woods. Did he need any other information? He decided he did. He needed to find out if the tree had fallen on his trusty Suburban and smashed the shit out of it. Of course, need was the wrong word. Need was for something you had to have, subtext being that if you could get it, you might be able to change the overall situation for the better, and nothing in this situation would change either way. And was situation the right word, or was it too general? It was more of a fix than a situation. Fix, in this context, meaning not to repair, but...
Stop it! He said. Do you want to drive yourself crazy?
He was pretty sure a part of him wanted exactly that. Somewhere inside his head, control panels were smoking and circuit breakers were fusing and some mad scientist was shaking his fists in exultation. He could tell himself it was the fever, but he had been in fine fettle when Village had gone bad. Same with the other two. Physically, at least. He got up, wincing at the aches that now seemed to be afflicting all of his joints, and went to the door, trying not to hobble. The wind tore it from his grasp and bounced it off the wall. He grabbed it and held on, his clothes plastered against his body and his hair streaming back from his forehead. The night was black. Black as the devil's riding boots, black as a black cat in a coal mine, black as a woodchuck's asshole. But he could make out the bulk of his Suburban and, maybe, tree branches waving above it on the far side. Although he couldn't be sure, he thought the tree had spared his Suburban and landed on the equipment shed, no doubt bashing in the roof. He shouldered the door shut and turned the deadbolt. He didn't expect intruders on such a dirty night, but he didn't want it blowing open after he went to bed. And he was going to bed. He made his way to the kitchen counter by the shifting, chancy light of the embers and lit the Coleman lantern. In its glare, the cabin looked surreal, caught by a flashbulb that didn't go out but just went on and on. Holding it in front of him, he crossed to the stairs. That was when he heard a scratching at the door. A branch, he told himself, blown there by the wind and caught somehow, maybe on the welcome mat. That's nothing. Go to bed. The scratching came again. So soft, he never would have heard it if the wind hadn't chosen those few moments to lull. It didn't sound like a branch. It sounded like a person. Like some orphan of the storm, too weak or badly hurt to even knock and could only scratch. Only no one had been out there. Or
Had there been? Could he be absolutely sure? It had been so dark. Black as the devil's riding boots. Drew went to the door, freed the deadbolt, and opened it. He held up the Coleman lamp. No one there. Then, as he was about to shut the door again, he looked down and saw a rat. Probably a Norway, not huge, but pretty big. It was lying on the threadbare welcome mat, one of its paws, pink, strangely human, like a baby's hand, outstretched and still scratching at the air. Its brown-black fur was littered with tiny bits of leaf, twig, and beads of blood. Its bulging black eyes were looking up at him. Its side heaved. That pink paw continued to scratch at the air, just as it had scratched at the door. A minuscule sound. Lucy hated rodents, screeched her head off if she saw so much as a field mouse scuttering along the baseboard. And it did no good to tell her the wee, sleek-it, cowering beastie was undoubtedly a lot more terrified of her than she was of it. Drew didn't care much for rodents himself and understood they carried diseases, hantavirus, rat-bite fever, and those were only the two most common, but he'd never had Lucy's almost instinctive loathing of them. What he mostly felt for this one was pity. Probably it was that tiny pink paw which continued scratching at nothing. Or maybe the pinpricks of white light from the Coleman lantern he saw in its dark eyes. It lay there panting and looking up at him with blood on its fur and in its whiskers, broken up inside, and probably dying. Drew bent, one hand on his upper thigh, the other holding down the lantern for a better look.
You were in the equipment shed, weren't you?
Almost surely. Then the tree had come down, smashing through the roof, destroying Mr. Rat's happy home. Had he been hit by a tree branch or a piece of the roof as he scuttled for safety? Maybe by a bucket of congealed paint? Had Pop's useless old McCulloch chainsaw tumbled off the table and fallen on him? It didn't matter. Whatever it was had squashed him and maybe broken his back. He'd had just enough gas left in his ratty little tank to crawl here. The wind picked up again, throwing sleet into Drew's hot face. Spicules of ice struck the globe of the lantern, hissed, melted, and ran down the glass. The rat panted. "The rat on the mat needs help stat," Drew thought. Except the rat on the mat was beyond help. You didn't need to be a rocket scientist. Except, of course, he could help. Drew walked to the dead socket of the fireplace, pausing once for a coughing fit, and bent over the stand containing the little collection of fireplace tools. He considered the poker, but the idea of skewering the rat with it made him wince. He took the ash shovel instead. One hard hit ought to be enough to put it out of its misery. Then he could use the shovel to sweep it off the side of the porch. If he lived through tonight, he had no wish to start tomorrow by stepping on the corpse of a dead rodent.
"Here is something interesting," he thought.
"When I first saw it, I thought, he. Now that I've decided to kill the damn thing, it's it." The rat was still on the mat. Sleet had begun crusting on its fur. That one pink paw, so human, continued to paw at the air, although now it was slowing down.
"I'm going to make it better," Drew said.
He raised the shovel, held it at shoulder height for the strike, then lowered it. And why? The slowly groping paw, the beady black eyes? A tree had crashed the rat's home and crushed him. Back to him now. He had somehow dragged himself to the cabin, God knew how much effort it had taken. And was this to be his reward? Another crushing? This one final? Drew was feeling rather crushed himself these days, and, ridiculous or not, probably it was, he felt a degree of empathy. Meanwhile, the wind was chilling him, sleet was smacking him in the face, and he was shivering again. He had to close the door, and he wasn't going to leave the rat to die slowly in the dark. And on a fucking welcome mat to boot. Drew set down the lantern and used the shovel to scoop it up. Funny how liquid that pronoun was. He went to the stove and tilted the shovel so the rat slid onto the floor. That one pink paw kept scratching. Drew put his hands on his knees and coughed until he dry-retched and spots danced in front of his eyes. When the fit passed, he took the lantern back to his reading chair and sat down.
"Go ahead and die now," he said. "At least you're out of the weather and can do it where you're warm."
He turned off the lantern. Now, there was just the faint red glow of the dying embers. The way they waxed and waned reminded him of the way that tiny pink paw had scratched and scratched and scratched. It was doing it still, he saw. "I should build up the fire before I go to bed," he thought. "If I don't, this place is going to be as cold as Grant's tomb in the morning." But the coughing, which had temporarily subsided, would no doubt begin again if he got up and started moving the phlegm around. And he was tired.
"Also, you put the rat down pretty close to the stove. I think you brought it in to die a natural death, didn't you? Not to broil it alive. Build the fire up in the morning."
The wind droned around the cabin, occasionally rising to a womanish screech, then subsiding to that drone again. The sleet slatted against the windows. As he listened to these sounds, they seemed to merge. He closed his eyes, then opened them again. Had the rat died? At first he thought it had, but then that tiny paw made another short, slow stroke. So, not quite yet. Drew closed his eyes and slept.
Chapter 22. He awoke with a start when another branch thudded down on the roof. He had no idea how long he had been out. It could have been 15 minutes, it could have been 2 hours. But one thing was sure. There was no rat in front of the stove. Apparently, Monsieur Rat hadn't been as badly hurt as Drew had thought. It had come around and was now somewhere in the house with him. He didn't much care for that idea, but it was his own fault. He had invited it in, after all.
"Have to invite them in," Drew thought. "Vampires. Wargs. The devil and his black riding boots. You have to invite
Drew." He started so strongly at the sound of that voice that he almost kicked over the lantern. He looked around, and by the light of the dying fire in the stove, saw the rat. He was on Pop's desk under the stairs, sitting on his back paws between the laptop and the portable printer, sitting, in fact, on the manuscript of Bitter River. Drew tried to speak, but at first could only manage a croak. He cleared his throat, which was painful, and tried again.
"I thought you just said something."
"I did." The rat's mouth didn't move, but the voice was coming from him, all right. It wasn't in Drew's head.
"This is a dream," Drew said. "Or delirium. Maybe both."
"No, it's real enough," the rat said. "You're awake, and you're not delirious. Your fever's going down. Check for yourself." Drew put a hand on his forehead. He did feel cooler, but that wasn't exactly trustworthy, was it? He was conversing with a rat, after all. He felt in his pocket for the kitchen matches he'd left there, struck one, and lit the lantern. He held it up, expecting the rat to be gone, but he was still there, sitting on his back paws with his tail curled around his haunches and holding his weird pink hands to his chest.
"If you're real, get off my manuscript," Drew said. "I worked too hard on it for you to leave a bunch of rat shit on the title page."
"You did work hard," the rat agreed, but showing no signs of relocating.
He scratched behind one ear, now seeming perfectly lively.
Whatever fell on him must have just stunned him, Drew thought.
If he's there at all, that is.
If he was ever there.
You worked hard, and at first you worked well. You were totally on the rails, running fast and hot. Then it started to go wrong, didn't it? Just like the other ones. Don't feel bad. Wannabe novelists all over the world hit the same wall. You know how many half-finished novels are stuck in desk drawers or filing cabinets? Millions.
Getting sick fucked me up.
Think back. Think honestly.
It was starting to happen even before that. Drew didn't want to think back.
You lose your selective perception, the rat said. It happens to you every time, on the novels at least. It doesn't happen at once, but as the book grows and begins to breathe, more choices need to be made, and your selective perception erodes. The rat went to all fours, trotted to the edge of Pop's desk, and sat up again like a dog begging for a treat. Writers have different habits, different ways of getting in the groove, and they work at different speeds. But to produce a long work, there must always come extended periods of focused narration.
I've heard that before, Drew thought. Almost word for word.
Where? At every single moment during those focused periods, those flights of fancy, the writer is faced with at least 7 choices of word and expression and detail. Talented ones make the right choices with almost no conscious consideration. They are pro basketball players of the mind, hitting from all over the court. Where? Who? A constant winnowing process is going on, which is the basis of what we call creative right. Franson! Drew bellowed, sitting upright and sending a bolt of pain through his head. That was part of the Franson lecture, almost word for word. The rat ignored this interruption. You are capable of that winnowing process, but only in short bursts. When you try to write a novel, the difference between a sprint and a marathon, it always breaks down. You see all the choices of expression and detail, but the consequent winnowing begins to fail you. You don't lose the words. You lose the ability to choose the correct words. They look all right. They look all wrong. It's very sad. You're like a car with a powerful engine and a broken transmission. Drew closed his eyes tight enough to make spots flare and then sprang them open. His orphan of the storm was still there. I can help you, the rat announced. If you want me to, that is.
And you do this because?
The rat cocked his head, as if unable to believe a supposedly smart man, a college English teacher who had been published in the New Yorker, could be so stupid.
You were going to kill me with a shovel, and why not? I'm just a lowly rat after all.
But you took me in instead. You saved me.
So, as a reward, you give me 3 wishes?
Drew said it with a smile. This was familiar ground. Hans Christian Andersen, Marie Catherine d'Aulnoy, the Brothers Grimm.
Just one, the rat said, a very specific one.
You can wish to finish your book. He lifted his tail and slapped it down on the manuscript of Bitter River for emphasis.
But it comes with a condition.
And that would be? Someone you care for will have to die. More familiar ground. This turned out to be a dream where he was replaying his argument with Lucy. He had explained, not very well, but he had given it the old college try, that he needed to write the book, that it was very important. She had asked if it was as important as she and the kids. He had told her no, of course not, then asked if it had to be a choice. I think it is a choice, she'd said, and you just made it.
This isn't actually a magic wish situation at all, he said. More of a business deal or a Faustian bargain. It's sure not like any of the fairy tales I read as a kid.
The rat scratched behind one ear, somehow keeping his balance while he did it. Admirable.
All the wishes in fairy tales come at a price. Then there's the monkey's paw. Remember that one? Even in a dream, Drew said, I would not trade my wife or either of my kids for an oat opera with no literary pretensions.
As the words came out of his mouth, he realized that was why he had seized the idea of Bitter River so unquestioningly. His plot-driven Western would never be stacked up against the next Rushdie or Atwood or Chabon, not to mention the next Franzen.
I would never ask you to, the rat said.
Actually, I was thinking of Al Stamper, your old department head. That silenced Drew. He just looked at the rat, which looked back with those beady black eyes. The wind blew around the cabin, sometimes gusting hard enough to shake the walls. The sleet rattled. Pancreatic, Al had said when Drew commented on his startling weight loss. But, he had added, there was no need for anyone to be crafting obituaries just yet. The docs caught it relatively early. Confidence is high. Looking at him, though, sallow skin, sunken eyes, lifeless hair, Drew had felt no confidence whatsoever. The key word in what Al had said was relatively. Pancreatic cancer was sly. It hid. The diagnosis was almost always a death sentence. And if he did die, there would be mourning, of course, and Nadine Stamper would be the chief mourner. They had been married for something like 45 years. The members of the English department would wear black armbands for a month or so. The obituary would be long, noting Al's many accomplishments and awards. His books on Dickens and Hardy would be mentioned. But he was 72 at least, maybe even 74, and nobody would say he died young or with his promise unfulfilled. Meanwhile, the rat was looking at him, its pink paws now curled against its furry chest.
What the hell? Drew thought. It's only a hypothetical question, and one inside a dream at that.
I guess I'd take the deal and make the wish, Drew said.
Dream or no dream, hypothetical question or not, he felt uneasy saying it.
He's dying anyway.
You finish your book, and Stamper dies, the rat said, as if to make sure Drew understood.
Drew gave the rat a cunning, sideways look.
Will the book be published?
I'm authorized to grant the wish if you make it, the rat said. I'm not authorized to predict the future of your literary endeavor.
Were I to guess, the rat cocked his head.
I'd guess it will be. As I said, you are talented.
Okay, Drew said. I finish the book, Al dies. Since he's going to die anyway, that seems okay to me.
Only it didn't. Not really.
Do you think he'll live long enough to read it, at least?
I just told you, Drew raised a hand.
Not authorized to predict the future of my literary endeavor, right?
Are we done here?
There's one more thing I need.
If it's my signature and blood on a contract, you can forget the whole deal.
It's not all about you, mister, the rat said. I'm hungry.
He jumped onto the desk's chair and from the chair to the floor. He sped across to the kitchen table and picked up an oyster cracker, one Drew must have dropped on the day he had the grilled cheese and tomato soup. The rat sat up, grasping the oyster cracker in its paws, and went to work. The cracker was gone in seconds.
Good talking to you, the rat said.
It disappeared almost as quickly as the oyster cracker, zipping across the floor and into the dead fireplace.
God damn, Drew said.
He closed his eyes, then sprang them open. It didn't feel like a dream. He closed them again, opened them again. The third time he closed them, they stayed closed.
Chapter 23. He awoke in his bed with no memory of how he'd gotten there. Or had he been here all night? That was more likely, considering how fucked up he'd been thanks to Roy DeWitt and his snotty bandana. The whole previous day seemed like a dream, his conversation with the rat only the most vivid part of it. The wind was still blowing, and the sleet was still sleeting, but he felt better, and there was no question of it. The fever was either going or entirely gone. His joints still ached and his throat was still sore, but neither was as bad as they had been last night, when part of him had been convinced he was going to die out here. Died of pneumonia on Shithouse Road. What an obituary that would have been. He was in his boxers, the rest of his clothes heaped on the floor. He had no memory of undressing either. He put them back on and went downstairs. He scrambled 4 eggs and this time ate them all, chasing each bite with orange juice. It was concentrate, all the Big 90 carried, but cold and delicious. He looked across the room at Pop's desk and thought about trying to work, maybe switching from the laptop to the portable typewriter to save the laptop's battery. But after putting his dishes in the sink, he trudged up the stairs and went back to bed, where he slept until the middle of the afternoon. The storm was still pounding away when he got up the second time, but Drew didn't care. He felt almost like himself again. He wanted a sandwich. There was bologna and cheese. And then he wanted to go to work. Sheriff Averill was about to fool the gun thugs with his big abracadabra, and now that Drew felt rested and well, he couldn't wait to ride it. Halfway down the stairs, he noticed that the toy box by the fireplace was lying on its side, with the toys that had been inside spilling out onto the rag rug. Drew thought he must have kicked it over on his sleepwalk to bed the previous night. He went to it and knelt, meaning to put the toys back in the box before starting work. He had the frisbee in one hand and the old Stretch Armstrong in the other, when he froze. Lying on its side, near Stacy's topless Barbie doll, was a stuffed rat. Drew felt his pulse throbbing in his head as he picked it up. So maybe he wasn't completely well after all. He squeezed the rat, and it gave a tired squeak. Just a toy, but sort of creepy, all things considered. Who gave their kid a stuffed rat to sleep with when there was a perfectly good teddy bear, only one eye, but still, in the same box? No accounting for tastes, he thought, and finished his mother's old maxim out loud, said the old maid as she kissed the cow. Maybe he'd seen the stuffed rat at the height of his fever and it had kicked off the dream. Make that probably, or almost certainly. That he couldn't remember searching all the way to the bottom of the toy box didn't signify. Hell, he couldn't even remember taking off his clothes and going to bed. He piled the toys back into the box, made himself a cup of tea, and went to work. He was doubtful at first, hesitant, a little scared. But after a few initial missteps, he caught hold and wrote until it was too dark to see without using the lantern. 9 pages. And he thought they were good. Damn good. Chapter 24. It wasn't a 3-day blow. Pierre actually lasted 4. Sometimes the wind and rain slackened, and then the storm would crank up again. Sometimes a tree fell, but none as close as the one that had smashed the shed. That part hadn't been a dream. He'd seen it with his own eyes. And although the tree, a huge old pine, had largely spared his Suburban, it had fallen close enough to tear off the passenger side mirror. Drew barely noticed these things. He wrote, he ate, he slept in the afternoon, he wrote again. Every now and then he had a sneezing fit, and every now and then he thought about Lucy and the kids, anxiously waiting for some word. Mostly, he didn't think about them. That was selfish, and he knew it, and didn't care. He was living in Bitter River now. Every now and then he had to pause for the right word to come to him, like messages floating up in the window of the magic 8-ball he'd had as a kid. and every now and then he had to get up and walk around the room as he tried to think of how to make a smooth transition from one scene to the next, but there was no panic, no frustration. He knew the words would come, and they did. He was hitting from all over the court, hitting from way downtown. He wrote on Pop's old portable now, pounding the keys till his fingers hurt. He didn't care about that either. He had carried this book, this idea that had come to him out of nowhere while standing on a street corner. Now it was carrying him. What a fine ride it was.